Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming.
So The Media Project offers you an opportunity for analysis, commentary, and if we're lucky, a little bit of insight even into the issues of the week. Greetings, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany, with my colleagues here, Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Always glad to be here.
It's wonderful to see you. And Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Nice to see you. It's been a while. I had to sprinkle the crumbs on the throughway to find my way back, sort of like Hansel and Gretel, but here I am.
Yes, yes. We're glad you did and took time out from your busy summer to be here.
Yes, my golf game is improving, which says two things, how bad it used to be and that I've got a little bit more time on my hands.
Well, you know, so it used to be in the days when newspapers sort of ran more on autopilot and the revenue rolled in, the golden days, that publishers could actually improve their golf game while they held
absolutely
their jobs.
I became a publisher in 1987, and even back then, which was a more flush time in the business, it still was not the way it was in the heyday. And I would tell people all the time. I said I thought the publisher came in the morning, opened the mail, and then went and played golf, and that did not happen once in my tenure. So
yeah,
so I'm making up for it now.
I became a newspaper editor in 1991, and then I became the editor of the Times Union in 2002, and 2002 was the last great year at the Times Union financially. It's been downhill ever since. Coincidental, I'm sure. anyway, Dr. Alan Chartok is out this week, and so we're just trying to make do without him. If Alan were here, he'd want to talk about, I think, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and a particular element of the political, let's say, I'm not going to use the word scandal, the hullabaloo that has engulfed him since the publication in the New York Times of a sort of expose of how he handled the Moreland Commission, an investigative commission on corruption. The question that I want to raise for the panel here is whether the press attention to this has turned into a question of piling on. You know, there's always this big story that everybody wants to get, and then you begin to wonder, what are we doing here? Are we just mimicking each other? All right, discuss, class.
Well, you know, it seems to me that the story is a major story in this state, in part because this was a governor who campaigned on ethics reform. This was a governor who formed a committee, a commission to address ethics reform, and what the revelations since then have shown to not put him in the best light. And so it's clearly a story. And the question of overkill, you know, I wonder how many of the average people in this state fully understand or even know about this because they're just not interested in it. So then the question is this just become inside baseball? Should it be inside baseball? And we're basically, we meaning the talking heads and the writing class are just talking to ourselves on this. So I think it's important. I think people should be aware of it and be digesting it, but I'm not sure people do digest it.
You know, the question is, does the story have legs or are we artificially giving it legs? Have there been any new developments? At the outset, when the New York Times story broke, we, of course, all had to write something because not every person reads the New York Times, and so all of our readers had to be informed about what was happening, and then our editorial writer had to weigh in, and our columnist had to weigh in. Now, 2 weeks into it, what is new? And so you have to really analyze, is there something new to report, or are we just piling on? It's something we really need to consider every time when we read every column, when we read every story.
So whether it's this story or another story, and you guys are talking to your reporters who are on the beat, and initially the story breaks, and everybody agrees it's an important story, and you send out your reporter or reporters to dig up as much as you can to see where this story is going to go, at some point, will you say, okay, the story has, even though it's still important, it's still something that the voters and the citizens should be thinking about, but at some point in time, does the story die of its own death? And you say, okay, no more coverage?
Well, unless new stuff comes out. And you then wrestle with the question of whether you're letting something important fall by the wayside, or whether you're just bucking it up to try to keep attention going on it. You know, one of the ways that these kinds of stories, if they have any taint of illegality to them, continue to draw attention is by people referring to them as scandal, which I think at this point this is not, and by attaching the word gate to it. You know, everything's got a gate after Watergate. And I heard a radio commentator refer to this as Moreland Gate, and I just about lost it. It just seems outrageous to me. That's stupid, basically. And it's inappropriate in the light of something like this, because this is, you know, Watergate involved paying hush money to cover up crimes from the White House. It involved trying to subvert the mission of the FBI by enlisting the CIA to lie to the FBI. I mean, Watergate was really terrible stuff. And we diminish what that was 40 years ago as we speak. The president was resigning, because we diminish it when we attach that to all sorts of things that don't really deserve that kind of attention.
Where, if at all, does it come into play that the current approval ratings of us, the media, are such that the politician who is under the gun can turn it around and basically saying, you know, what do you expect from these guys? Or I don't believe a word did you read in the paper. And does that impact your editorial judgments as to how you're going to play? In other words, is he able, in this case Cuomo, but it could be any politician, that pushback is felt more in the newsrooms than it might have been 50 years ago, 30 years ago?
You know, I don't think so at all. When I hear that, I tend to ignore it. There are logical follow-ups when we get the polls about how the governor's approval rating has declined. Legitimate story. Now you see his political opponents coming out and criticizing what happened and trying to keep the story alive. I think this is when good reporters and good editors can use their judgment to say, is this really a valid criticism at this point, or are they piling on, as they do quite often?
My colleague and predecessor, Harry Rosenfeld, who was editor of the Times Union for many years, immediately prior to coming to this paper, had been the assistant managing editor at the Washington Post, and he had been in charge of local coverage during Watergate there. So he was the guy who hired Bob Woodward, and he oversaw the coverage of Watergate. And he makes a very interesting point, looking back 40 years to the coverage of Watergate at the Post, of how the administration consistently attacked the Post for being anti-Nixon, anti-Republican, and how there was a chorus that supported that. Therefore, Rosenfeld worked very hard to make sure that his reporters didn't do anything that might encourage that point of view. There was no exulting in the Post newsroom when Nixon resigned. They had been instructed not to do any such thing. There wasn't as much in those days either appearance by print reporters and on television and so on. You know, this has become, I think it's partly because, of course, with cable, there's the 24-hour need for programming, but also because of the nature of media now, where there's a lot of sharing. Our reporters nowadays would be seen in lots of other venues, and it would seem as though we were pushing a story rather than reporting.
Well, on a similar note, then, in Albany, and I'm not in Albany, so correct me if my characterization is inaccurate, but in Albany, where the governor does not go out of his way to speak to the media, he seems to have one or two favored radio stations where he regularly appears. I don't see him very often doing print interviews or editorial boards. And he came into office with a reputation from his days in his father's administration as being, to put it politely a tough guy, to the extent that that has riled or irked the Albany press corps, does that motivate their zeal to cover this perhaps more so than they should, this meaning the Moreland issue?
I don't know. I think the press corps generally is made up of equal opportunity jerks. You know, I suppose it's probably impossible to avoid being a little bit harsher on somebody who treats you badly. Although, you know, I don't know. Maybe I should think more cautiously about that, because I think we try very hard. And reporters don't, you know, sometimes politicians who kind of bend over backwards to, in effect, suck up to the media are the people that you'd really rather just not deal with. Thank you very much.
Well, I can only personalize this in this way. When we, and I was still active, when we endorsed the governor for his election the last time, he ran against Carl Paladino, as you remember, who was not exactly a stellar candidate on a number of levels. And
Mr. Warm and Fuzzy,
yeah,
right?
But for the only time that I can remember in my history at an editorial board, we endorsed the governor, and I believe we said, even though we know he's an SOB, we still believe he's the best of these candidates.
Right. He's our SOB.
Yeah.
We thought he would be effective, I think is what editorial words. Yeah. And, you know, another story just along this line that strikes me, we've recently had a lot of attention to a video that went rather viral of a congressman from our area, Paul Tonko, speeding on the thruway. A person, when this car went around him with congressional plates, caught up with him and claimed that the guy was going 93 miles an hour. Seems to be the case. But boy, has that gotten a lot of attention. And, you know, my concern about it, what annoys me about it, is that we routinely pay little attention to what members of Congress are doing actually in the legislative halls. What gets our attention is when something like this happens, and it gets overplayed.
And you actually had the video of the car speeding, or of him being, was he pulled over?
No. Just running along. And
now, people can relate to that. They can't relate to the Moreland Committee, but we've all been on the throwaway and seen that state legislator zip by us at 100 miles an hour and say, how come that guy doesn't get pulled over?
It becomes a big deal. Our reporter who first reported this actually then went into the congressman's schedule from that time to see where he was and why he was speeding. You know?
And the problem clearly was he was going to 15 different events that morning quickly from one spot to another. You know, we should take some responsibility for that, but also let's blame the internet, because the fact that the video went viral, that it was very popular on our website, played into the fact that this was an issue that people cared about. So we have this instant response from our readers all the time that, yeah, they care about kittens, they care about speeding cars, they care about goofy videos. It's something we have to balance our news coverage with all the time, it seems like.
We do. In our afternoon meeting where we decide what goes on the front page, the first thing we do is we look at the metrics from the day, the digital metrics, and we actually have a report of what has been getting the most traffic. It's not what determines at all what we put into the paper, because it's, you know, those are two different products, what people look at digitally during the day and what they actually want to read in the paper. So it's not determinative, but it's not dispositive, but it's interesting. So it's worth weighing now. And we think about that kind of thing. It gives us more insight into what people really care about. Kittens, as you said, right?
Speeding congressman.
Yeah, exactly. Allegedly, that's right. this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio, from the studios in Albany, New York, of WAMC. Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York, Judy Patrick of the Gazette in Schenectady, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and we're grateful to have all of you here. We added Geneva to our
Switzerland
list last week. No, not that one. Sorry.
I guess somebody send me some chocolate.
Yeah. I think we're on in Cairo, too, but it's the one in Illinois that's pronounced like the
But we're on in Cairo, New York.
Right down the road. Here's an interesting moment. I don't know if you all saw the cute video clip of Brian Williams of NBC News reporting that his daughter had been cast as Peter Pan. It was a neat little story. She's already hit Allison Williams from something of a star from her work on the HBO series Girls. And so she's been cast to play Peter Pan in live telecast that NBC's doing, and And he added a little cute thing about, at the end, he said, family members confirm she's been rehearsing for this role since the age of 3 and look forward to seeing her fly. So my question is, what do you do when you are in the media and you have somebody close to you, when you are connected to a story that needs to be covered?
Well, you know, if Brian Williams' daughter was cast as Peter Pan and Peter Pan was going to air live on CBS or ABC and he did that story, I would say, well, that's great. That's a proud father. And it's only partially that. There's so much cross promotion on the networks. NBC has bottled it. You know, stories that they do routinely on the Today Show and on the Nightly News that are involved with programming they have elsewhere on the network is just over the top. I try to think whether there is a newspaper equivalency to that, and I can't think of any, although there may be some. I just think, you know, let's just drop the pretenses. We're doing this story today on Peter Pan because Peter Pan is going to air on November whatever on NBC, and here's where you tune it in, and let's just be done with it. But otherwise, it's not news.
Yeah, what would Huntley and Brinkley say about this? I always think of those nightly newscasts as real news, and the fact that this is starting to intrude in them, I think it diminishes that part of the day. Sure, the Today Show has gone into the entertainment realm, but you know, I always thought the 6 o'clock news or the 6:30 news was something special, and I'm sad to see that happened.
Well, maybe one of the reasons that there's more viewership, the Today Show has become the preeminent product of NBC News rather than in nightly news, is because it's moved into that entertainment realm. You know?
Well, fine, but then let's just call it what it is. You know, I do think there could be, tell me if you've experienced the same thing, a newspaper equivalent. If a newspaper company is sponsoring a community event,
yes.
It is more likely to give coverage to that event on its news pages.
That absolutely happens. That does happen, and you can say, in fact, you know, you could make a good argument that you're creating journalism when you do some of those events. You know, we taped a program with the State Education Commissioner and a couple educators at the public television station recently, and that produced a story. So it made news in our little realm. I don't think it made news anywhere else.
But would you have covered it if another newspaper had
if
sponsored
Judy's
it?
If Judy's paper had been covering it, I don't think we would have covered it.
Right, and more newspapers are turning to these events as a way to make money.
Yeah.
So do you cover the baby boomer event? Do you cover the ski show? Do you cover the flower show? If they're big enough, I guess you do. Do you cover competitor show? If they're big enough, you know, you kind of hold your nose and cover it.
Well, we always cover the Daily Gazette Christmas Parade, for example. That's the biggest event in Schenectady, right?
Right.
At least in the wintertime. And it's a named event sponsored by the Gazette. So there's that, you know. And sometimes the corporate naming rights kind of nail you, not even in a competitor. You know, we have in Albany, we have the Tulip Festival. And there is a stage where bands perform throughout the weekend Tulip Festival in June. And that stage is named for a bank. I don't actually remember at this moment which bank, probably KeyBank. And the difficulty is that if you don't use the name of the bank when you're in your coverage, you get a call from the bank. Is that appropriate? They paid money for that naming right.
And the bank is one of your advertisers.
Well, that's true too. Yeah. It probably is,
which is why they're calling and leaning on you.
Yeah, I you know, it could.
I mean, you go back to the more innocent days. I'm thinking two or so decades ago when sporting events such as the Orange Bowl and the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl used to be called the Orange Bowls, the Rose Bowls, and the Sugar Bowl. Now they're the Tostitos, whatever. And I can recall way back when. And I don't know whether AP still does it, but we did it. We dropped the name of the sponsor. We just, because people didn't know it as the Tostitos Sugar Bowl. They knew it as the Sugar Bowl. Now, and I was going to move it even farther, are you hesitant to say an event is at the Times Union Center because it's at Times Union? Or do you say it's at the arena in Albany?
No, you've got to call it what it is.
You got to call it what it is.
That's the case. What do you do about the Buick Open, you know, which is
used to be the Westchester or whatever it is. Uh-huh. And now the name is sort of rolled in, so they pretty much use it. The golf tournament most recently, as we speak, used to be called the Firestone, not because it was a name of a tire, but because that was the name of the club. But now it's Bridgestone something or other, and that name is widely used. So it's folded into the discourse. We almost don't even think about it anymore.
Bridgestone is the name of the tournament that's played at the Firestone
Course. Yeah, isn't
that
interesting?
It's cute. Well, it's the same company.
Is it?
Yeah.
The marketers there.
it's quite amazing.
Go back to where we started. You know, when the Olympics are on, and NBC has the Olympics from now until the next three generations, all of their programming is tied into the Olympics, and so much of the time on their air is tied into the Olympics. You don't see a similar amount of time on ABC or NBC. It's just it suggests to me that beyond the obvious, that they're just overplaying a story that should not be played as much as it is. And to the extent that the public does not recognize why they are doing it, it presents a disproportionate level of importance in their mind, and it colors their thinking.
You know, the problem is that I think people don't understand that we bend over backwards to avoid these problems in our what we might call legitimate press. At the Times Union, we had a sports editor who had a teenage daughter who was part of a national contender crew team. You know, she would get up early in the morning and go row. And this great crew team from Shenandoah High School here in upstate New York was competing in a national championship. And the sports editor came to me quite concerned because he said, you know, it's going to look like I'm putting this in the paper because my daughter's a member of the team. And I said, no, you really have to go ahead and do this. This genuinely is newsworthy. This deserves attention. But we are concerned about this. My predecessor in this job was married to a woman who was a criminal defense lawyer. And sometimes in the afternoon meeting, he would simply get up and leave the room. And I was the managing editor at the time. He would say to me, you'll have to take it from here. And I would later find out that it's because he had seen on the news budget that we were about to discuss a client of his wife's. And we didn't know why he left the room, but he didn't even want to have anything to do with the notion that we might decide to cover a story or not. I think there's a cynicism that people assume that we make judgments based upon who's an advertiser, or how we're going to sell papers, or something that there is favoritism, when in fact we probably really bend over backwards almost too far the other way.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and speaking about the whether there's coverage deserves to be coverage, let me toss something out at you guys. This Ebola crisis, the Ebola scare, in my view, it obviously is something that needs to be disseminated. What is it? What does it mean to us? What is the impact potentially on us? Has the media, particularly the broadcast media, gone overboard in the coverage to the point where we're out now all hiding under our beds? Or is it properly being covered in the volume that it is?
You know, I think the real press has done a fairly good job with moderating the
real
coverage.
Press, meaning print.
But you know what was scary is social media. The tweet world went crazy with this. And if you just relied on tweets and never clicked through to links, it was a scary time. And it's concerning because so many young people, I guess they're not on Twitter so much anymore, but they rely on social media for the hint of what's in the news today.
Mm-hmm. Most of us don't know a lot about what this is, and so we needed to be educated. And it certainly is a real crisis in Western Africa. Is it Western Africa where it exists, where I believe it's 1,600 lives have been lost? But we are also learning that you just can't catch this by being breathed upon, much like perhaps a flu, you know, just a common cold. You have to interchange body fluids. So the threat on the one hand is serious. On the other hand, we're not looking, and I hope I'm not proven wrong, we're not looking at a thing where people are going to be dropping dead in the streets in this country. So I just wonder whether there is the proliferation of coverage, particularly on cable, is just creating a scare.
Yeah.
A scare. You know, until yesterday, I thought this was a great question, which was, did anybody here ever hear of Bo Bergdahl? I mean, Bo Bergdahl was on the news from one end of the day to the other end of the day about, 2 months ago? And then he disappeared. There was Israel. There was whatever the crises of the moment. And now it's Ebola. Now, Bo Bergdahl, as we speak, happened to have shown up yesterday because they're starting to interview him to see if he's maybe guilty of desertion. But the story of the day just disappears from the news because it's substituted by another story of the day.
The relentless flow of the news. The thing about Ebola that concerns me is that it may be very much like the early days of the AIDS crisis. crisis, when media coverage fueled an hysteria mm-hmm. that was unrealistic about what the actual susceptibility of individuals might be to it. We had people who were afraid to be around. And I remember we had a state senator from this community who wanted to label children who might be HIV positive so that kids wouldn't come close to them on the playground. You know, they might come into contact with them on the playground, he said. Well, you know, we've learned a little about the crisis.
Well, some of us have. You have the famed Donald Trump, who tweeted famously that the two people who they brought back to this country should not have been brought back to the country. They should have kept that virus there with them. And that's the kind of stupidity and that creates and adds fuel to the
more dangerous virus is Trump.
Yeah.
Anyway. That's about all we have time for before we start making a list of the people.
We're making the listeners sick.
We're grateful to you anyway for joining us. Ira Fussfeld of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, Judy Patrick of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks for joining us this week on the Media Project.
Ding-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people, it's wonderful to represent the press.